Hi, everybody. This is Michael Martin of Martin Chronicle. I have a great guest today. He just wrote a phenomenal book. It's called The Fearful Rise of Markets. His name is John Authors. He's a rather famous investment columnist from Financial Times. He just took over the Lex column, and I'm on the phone with him today from my hometown of New York City. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome. This is a great book. For those of you who haven't read it yet, I would encourage you to go get it and read it. The book is very well broken up, and each chapter is summarized at the end with several bullets of what needs to be done and what John's suggestions are. John, first question. Yesterday there were some regulations passed, you know, the bill, the famous financial reform. With respect to the timeline in your book of, like, before the rise, then the decline, and then the fearful rise, do you think this recent pass of the bill will have any effect or annulling features of the fearful rises?
If you ask me if it'll have any effect, yes, it'll probably have some effects because it has some. It makes it somewhat easier for regulators to do a basic competent job. I do think the movement of some derivatives onto exchanges makes sense, and I think the wind-up provisions make sense. I don't, however, think they're actually the central or most important issues facing us, and that those are issues that we still haven't addressed. The key issue was, I would say, first of all, leverage, that everybody was over-leveraged by the time the balloon went up.
Right.
And that will come down to reserve ratios, and there was much less in FinReg than there might have been. We have to wait with bated breath for the Basel Committee on that one, which is still a long way off, and that's still the single most important issue. And on the broader issue of moral hazard, the notion that people are more likely to take extreme risks if they think they're going to get bailed out if there's a problem. The thing that most scares me about the whole wake of the crisis so far is that usually crises deal with moral hazard because people who've been taking too many risks suddenly lose a lot of money and they behave differently in future. That's not been the case this time because I think probably rightly back in September and October the government decided that there was nothing for it but to dive in and rescue them.
Right.
There is still nothing in here to try to address that issue of moral hazard. It's an extremely difficult issue to address. Maybe it involves, again, coming down back to reserve ratios, forcing banks to get smaller, but there is nothing in here yet to start the process of forcing people to realize that they have their head is on the block, that they have something at risk. And so, it'll help a bit at the margin, but we still haven't come to the most important stuff.
Huh. That's very interesting, given the spirit of your book. On some level, you don't have to confirm or deny this. You must feel somewhat, because your conclusions are very, very clear, you must feel somewhat let down. Do you think that this was going to be geared, this recent bill is more geared to be what looks like a political win, but at the end of the day is terribly, pardon the expression, flaccid?
I could sign up to that. I'm not sure I would use precisely those words, but I'm trying to remember exactly which words we used in Lexi. It was certainly something where at one point there was a risk of a populist overreaction.
Right.
It's more or less inevitable that banks will be less profitable after a sensible re-regulation than they were before. That's fair enough, but that's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. At one point, we were talking about punitive taxation, which would have been far too far in the other direction.
Yeah.
I think at this point, although I don't particularly like government intervention in markets, we haven't gone far enough that there were serious problems here. That some of it comes down to both bankers behaving irresponsibly and regulators not doing their jobs properly either. But more was needed, I think, to redress the balance, to try to deal with the issues that emerge with the moral hazard that had built up. Broadly speaking, I would have preferred something more from FinReg.
I I spoke with Glenn Yeago at Milken Institute, Jim Rogers, Victor Sparandio, Barry Ritholtz, a few folks who are fairly well-educated in this and follow it maybe even more closely than I do. I'm from the mind that guns aren't evil, the people are evil. And so despite regulatory actions, I'm not sure that even if you came down and you cut the leverage down to 2-to-1, they wouldn't find another loophole, because that's how capitalism works, right? They would originate new products that got through the loopholes.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, it comes down to how sensibly participants are doing their job, and how diligently regulators are doing their job. Quite. I mean, the classic apparently innocuous example from all that we've just lived through is the money market funds. You know,
right.
it made sense because it enabled you to get around paying to the FDIC. The FDIC was one of the less interesting reforms of the 1930s, but did actually rid us of bank runs, which had been a peculiarly severe American problem for many generations before the 30s. Naturally, after Lehman, as soon as one money market fund did indeed take a loss, we had an old-fashioned bank run on money market funds. I mean, that's their job. That's the job of financial innovation, to try to find ways around the regulations, and it's the job of regulators to keep up with them. And if all sides do their job properly, then we have an innovative but ultimately stable financial system that helps allocate capital to where it can be most used most productively. And we haven't had that for a while, and I'm not sure we're going to have it for the next matter of years either. But I agree with the basic point that you're making, is that human ingenuity is to try to get around rules, that you can't sort out that much purely by regulation. You have to always understand, it's one of the great insights from behavioral economics, you have to understand that this all has to be filtered through human nature.
I always likened it to you know, they say in physics that, you know, water will seek its own level, basically, if you let it loose. And I kind of feel capitalism is the same way. And I'm convinced that there are people who originate products that sit there and they look at the tax code, they look at the legal code, and they look at, you know, transparency, leverage, where and how things are traded, whether they're, you know, centralized in a centralized meeting place, i.e. an exchange, or over-the-counter or dealer-driven things like preferred stocks or otherwise over the phone. And they come up with these hybrid scenarios in structure, legality, taxation, custody, and then, if I didn't say it already, the medium through which they're exchanged between buyer and seller. And that's where origination, that's where Adam meets Eve on Wall Street, because in the origination, that's where I can sit back and fantasize in East Hampton about my bonus and my Maybach and my house in on Fifth Avenue, is to come up with something that hasn't been done before. So I would share, I think, your concern that this regulatory component that's gone through puts up a speed bump, but it isn't even really that big of a speed bump.
Precisely. I mean, we can speak more positively. If you have more in the way of crude regulations, then it gives us that much longer of a period of time before things get totally overheated again, and that's a longer period of time for banks to build up balance sheets for everybody to regain some kind of an equilibrium. Ultimately, human ingenuity is what it is, and greed is what it is. The problem, again, this comes back to the central issue of moral hazard, is that capitalism relies on greed to be tempered by fear, which for a long time it hasn't been.
Yeah, which is very unorthodox for me, and comes, you know, ideologically 180 degrees out of phase as a sine curve from how I would run money. Because I wake up in the morning and I always sleep with one foot on the floor. And, you know, this is about you and your book, not about me. But I always assume, like, if I smell smoke, I assume it's a 5-alarm fire. I know I can make a lot of money, but my gains are only going to look like gains to the extent that I can keep my losses small. So that's always the first order of business, is to make sure that I don't take a body shot from Mike Tyson. Because just by luck, if I can get a 4x4 or a 2x4 across his head, I might win the round.
But sadly, in aggregate, you're not a very typical manager of money by the sounds of it,
yeah.
because One of the things that amazes me is how short memories are. I mean, I was doing this when we went through the internet bubble, and it really is stunning that something like this could recur within a generation of that. You would have thought that everybody who was around managing money in 1999 and 2000 would have learned quite a lesson from that, and they hadn't. And so, you know, the normally in most people, hope springs eternal.
Yeah,
and it's interesting that the people who are always most concerned about what could go wrong, in the very long run, tend to do best. But then again, this comes to another one of the points I try to make in the book: that the incentives on the big institutionalized money management industry are really almost against that. You know, the people who are smart enough to sit out the internet bubble don't feel smart because money walked out of the door, and even after the dust had settled, they would probably have been better off churning their clients into the internet bubble. The incentives in the industry, and you know, it's no longer the ultimate investor that counts. It's their agents, it's the big institutional managers and the hedge fund managers that count. The incentives are such that that we've had the kind of propensity to bubbles that we've had.
On the next call, we'll have to spend the entire time speaking about who is a fiduciary, because that's a very interesting concept right now. It's like, as an agent, you typically represent the firm you're selling for, but if you're trying to be a financial advisor, it's very difficult to put the client's needs first. And I'll share with you, if I'm earning a 2-20 fee structure, I'm more of a fiduciary than some guy working at a wirehouse, because I won't make any more money unless I make the client money. If I don't make money, I don't get paid. You know, there's not too many guys on Wall Street working at the big wirehouses that would subscribe to that point of view, which brings me to the second question here in the book. Page 24, for those of you who are following along with the do you have, or would you suggest an alternative to passive index investing, such as maybe something that involves momentum? You know, Mebben Faber wrote the Ivy Portfolio book, and he delineated in several instances where it's been studied and proven that momentum is more important than asset allocation. And you got John Bogle writing books like Enough, which I think are a total crock. And I think there's a big con going on Wall Street where if you keep saying to people, buy and hold, you can't time the market. I know that is categorically false, but I don't think the street gives people enough credit that they can learn how to manage risk.
I think value and momentum strategies are a very interesting, very interesting school in that you're taking advantage of two separate ways in which the market tends towards inefficiency at different times in the cycle, and between the two of them, there are very interesting cases where you should be able to outperform. The other thing is the idea of actually, rather than passive indexing, going for the various kinds of enhanced index. I think tend to be overhyped, but fundamental indexing is a very interesting notion. That begins to get at part of the problem that comes with passive indexing, which is that in aggregate, passive indexing is bad for the efficiency of markets. Index funds are dumb. They don't look for inefficiencies. They don't look to exploit inefficiencies. They just pile in further. And I think that is, you know, certainly one factor behind the growth of extra production of bubbles we've had in the last generation. Much money has passively just followed wherever the money is going.
Mm-hmm. In light of the statistic that I've read, and the number kind of changes from year to year, but 7 out of 8, you know, 87% or 7/8 of the managers don't outperform their benchmark. We have 9,000 mutual funds. It seems like we have as many funds as there are securities that are traded.
Yeah, that's...
In light of the Investment Company Act of 1940, and for those of you who don't know what that is the body of law that regulates management companies, both closed-ended funds and open-ended companies, known as mutual funds. Mm. In Section 5B1 of that, it delineates what has to be considered by a manager or a management company in order to be considered a diversified management company. And one of them, without getting too inside baseball, is that at any given time, 75% of the assets under management or the net assets have to be invested primarily in a long-only strategy.
Mm.
Now, if you look at what you just talked about and what you wrote about very cunningly in the book about passive index investing, which is arguably 100% invested long-only.
Generally, that's what they claim to be, and generally they're pretty close to it, yeah.
Yeah. So do you think that managers, given that 7 out of 8 of them don't outperform their benchmark, that in action, you know, coming back to my statement before, that my gains only look like gains to the extent that I keep my losses small, do you think if we allowed managers to play more defensive, that their performance would actually go up?
That's quite conceivable, although you also have to bear in mind that they might get their asset allocation wrong as well as their as well as their stock selection.
I
think the idea in general that investors should be when I'm referring to investors here, I'm talking to the kinds of people who aren't game for to really try to actively manage their money, but plainly do need to have money saved up for their retirement. I think quite a lot of the problems with it would be dealt with if we moved to a system where they're put into funds where there is much more active asset allocation and where there is much more of an ability to become much more defensive or conservative. That's one of the points I didn't really explain as well as that's in there in the book that I didn't explain as well as I would have liked to. Where certainly at the moment there is ultimately an encouragement to stay over heavily there for too long. With the result, as you can see, the whole institutional managed money complex tends to lead to overheated markets.
Yes.
And then crashes. So something where the default option isn't the S&P 500, but some reasonably sensibly managed fund where, yes, you do have the ability to go pretty high into cash and into bonds, and maybe into some hedge fund strategies makes quite a lot of sense to me. I mean, you've obviously got to give people alternatives. It's a default option rather than a compulsory option, and you obviously have to have competition. But that if we move towards that as a central model rather than putting together your own little portfolio of long-only funds and allowed managers to try to compete with each other more on the basis of whether they got their asset allocation right, you might move to a healthier market.
Speaking of
healthier, more efficient market, I should say, rather than healthier, a market where prices remain somewhat more efficiently set.
Speaking of asset allocation, there's a lot been written about the role of commodities.
Mm.
When you talk about commodities, you have to talk about the physical producers and users as well as commodity investors, which are different from commodity speculators.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the role of commodities, whether it's part of the asset allocation or whether you think, and don't be bashful, the role that I play in the marketplace is amoral?
I find the use of the word speculator somewhat annoying in that it's obviously a pejorative word. In commodities markets, there's plainly a very useful traditional role for speculators in providing the liquidity so that producers and consumers can find a point at where both of them can buy or sell futures at a price that makes sense to them. When we're talking about, I do tend fairly strongly to the view that that the idea of buying futures by going long commodity futures and staying long and taking advantage of the roll yield every month, that, you know, treating this as a sort of passive indexed investment in commodities strikes me as an approach which is dangerous and which has which did contribute to the extraordinary bubble we had in oil in 2008. One of the great facets of what happened in 2008 that surprises me hasn't been much more closely analysed and discussed. So I think the whole notion that you could mechanistically treat commodities as one big holistic asset class and rely on it not to be correlated with stocks and bonds was a bad one, which helped make the events of 2008 that much worse than they otherwise would have been. I'm not sure it would help anybody to call it immoral. I think in retrospect, that kind of investment in commodities looks as though it was ill-advised. I wouldn't say commodity speculators were doing God's work either, but I don't regard commodity speculation, as I understand the term anyway, to be a necessarily bad idea. It's often a very good one.
I believe he's a fellow countryman of yours, John Kemp, writes for Reuters. I think it was yesterday he wrote an article that talked about the carry trade in crude oil and how it's not a favorable trade these days compared to when, you know, the broker dealers and the big FCMs were buying, you know, they were doing the cash and carry trade. He basically said that this is no longer the time. Not to promote someone else's book, but another fellow countryman, Tom Bauer, wrote a good book called Oil. And in the book, he discusses peak oil and how it was actually the physical traders at Shell and at Chevron and at the places where, you know, because they can see where the tankers were going and what the production was, that they could actually corner the market and have a profound effect on peak oil, more so than guys like myself. Not to rub any salt in anyone's wounds, but I'm of the mindset that I couldn't manipulate crude if I had Hurricane Katrina at my back. But people want to believe what they want to believe, and that's fine. I can share with you that I will never stop speculating in crude oil or anything else. And as they say, you're going to have to pull my mouse out of my cold, dead hand. I appreciate your candor on commodities. In regards to herding, John, do investors have too many choices? If I walk into E-Trade or Fidelity or Vanguard and I've got $1,000, what's going through my head?
You've got $1,000, I remember this from covering it in the late 90s. You may well already be prone to be told that you can start doing your own asset allocation, switching from between funds on the internet, and it's all a profoundly bad idea. I mean, I'm nervous about making points like this because I don't want to seem like I'm recommending paternalism or anything like that. But there's a big sense in which the investment industry now is a little bit like the hi-fi industry used to be. You know, there would be all these buttons along the front of the along the front of the amplifier, and you wouldn't have a clue what any of them did, and you wouldn't be able to hear any difference if you pressed the button. But they carried on doing it because it made people feel as though they were being given something a bit more if there were more buttons there. And to some extent, the sheer proliferation. I think the Morningstar style box, where everything is divided into along metrics of whether they're growth, core, or value, as well as whether they're small, medium, or large caps,
right.
And it gives you a nice 9 boxes before you start. I think that's similarly an example of making things over elaborate and making it easier for intermediaries to convince you that you need their help, and making it easy for them to justify their existence by having more to do. I think, again, there's a difference between what the majority of us should do with our retirement money. I'm not for a second saying if you want to go out full-time and try to beat the market and try to make your living by being an investor or a speculator.
Your point speaks to the folks and their relative investment success in something that had the ticker symbol FMAGX, and for those of you who are uninitiated, that is the ticker symbol for Fidelity Magellan, which has gone through its sort of managers, and one being Peter Lynch. I've read several statistics that showed that because people were jumping in and jumping out and they had the access to their money, that the majority of folks who had actually owned Fidelity Magellan, because you can't sell it short, actually lost money, whereas the performance of the manager himself, Peter Lynch, was positive.
I think that's true of many top performing mutual funds, is that they do very well when they're very small and nimble. Most of the money comes in at or near the top, and so if you weight it by actual dollars invested rather than notional initial units,
yes,
a lot of the best performers over history turn out to have lost money on average for their investors.
And kudos
very
to
sad.
Peter, kudos to Peter Lynch for getting out at the top of the market in terms of track record. And
yes,
and
I mean he did brilliant. The guy plainly was something fairly special in knowing. You know, he's one of the most successful long only equity managers in history, plainly. But yes. One of the hardest things to do is to get out when you're ahead, and he was one of the few who managed to do that. You were mentioning Mike Tyson earlier. You know,
yeah.
There aren't many people who manage to get out while they're ahead. But yes, you're quite right. The whole story of Magellan I find to be fascinating, very useful as a model for all the problems of the industry as a whole and the contradictions that are involved with institutional managing of money.
The last question, I'm not sure if it was addressed in the bill, but you're the kind of guy who certainly, if you don't have the answer, this is something that you'll probably cult. This is a pearl that you'll be culturing for the next couple of years. And it deals with something that that I know about, having spent, thank God, not too much time in the broker-dealer space, and that is the Securities Investor Protection Act of 1970. So whenever you see a broker-dealer, whether it's member New York Stock Exchange or member NASD, you'll also see member SIPC. And that is the industry-funded insurance company that you pay into based on your size. So if you and I have a small broker-dealer of $10 million under management, we're going to pay a pittance in, whereas someone like J.P. Morgan or the Goldman Sachs folks who are doing God's work will be paying, you know, tens of millions of dollars into the system. Now, this could also be a bit of a moral hazard. Every Friday or so, there's a blog that comes out that reports the banks that have failed and that FDIC has to bail out. Well, SIPC is what bails out investors if their broker-dealer becomes insolvent. Have you, in all the people in your confidential sources, without mentioning any names, has this ever come up as a conversation topic, as a potential moral hazard?
This particular one hasn't. It's as the debate continues in Europe, where there are various mutual, that's in the sense of funds mutually held by different banks to cooperatively insure themselves and smaller banks.
Right.
You realize how difficult it is to design any system of insurance in the financial sphere that doesn't raise the issue of moral hazard. Yes, there is a morally hazardous issue there. If it's mutually run and there's peer group pressure, there is somewhat more ability to police it. The moral hazard issues are less than if you have what we've resorted to in the last few years, which is fairly straightforward after the event interventions of taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
Plainly, that's less morally hazardous, but it's still surprisingly difficult, as people really are beginning to try to work out in some detail how they're going to do it, how you can do that without still providing some sense to people that they will be, that there won't be a downside, that they can get away with it. But the point you've raised is not one I've heard raised before, and it's a very important one, a very interesting point.
Well, I guess that makes me top of the class.
Well done.
I don't know about that, but my guest today has been John Authors. He's the editor at FT, Financial Times. And the book is called The Fearful Rise of Markets, Global Bubbles, Synchronized Meltdowns, and How to Prevent Them in the Future. I didn't mention the foreword's written by Muhammad El-Aryan. It's available on hardcover and in the Kindle edition. John sent me a copy here. Thank you, John. And I'd love to have you back and talk about more of these issues in the future if you're amenable. And, you know, we'll try to keep it short and sweet.
It'll be a pleasure. And it has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, John. Thank you.